This is Bob Kaiser. The course is Power to Become, Explorations in the Gospel of John, Session 3, Free to Believe. John 1:12, but to all who received him who believed in his name, he gave power to become children of God. The power to become that we've been talking about, that we've been searching for, is given to those who believe, those who receive Christ. But that raises the question, what does it mean to believe? If my belief, if my reception of that power is somehow dependent upon my belief, what does it mean to believe? Are we free to believe or not to believe as we wish? What is faith after all? So this leads us into three related questions concerning the Gospel of John that I'd like to explore this morning. The first question is very simply, what is the meaning of faith in the Gospel of John? And that will lead us to the question of John's dualism that we'll have to talk about. And then the third question is, are we free to believe, or is faith predetermined by the act of God? I put that question last to keep you on the edge of your seats, you see, until then. So we begin this morning by asking, what is the meaning of faith in the Gospel of John? First of all, I might say that in the Greek, there is no distinction between faith and belief. There's one word, the noun to believe, pistuein, and then pistis, the verb to believe, and the noun pistis, which is translated either belief or faith, and there really is no difference, you see. So if I move back and forth between those, it's not because there aren't perhaps subtle theological differences, but because the New Testament doesn't make that kind of distinction. We might ask, first of all, in the Gospel of John, what is the object of faith, of believing? In what, to what, are we asked to believe? And actually, there are three objects of believing in the Gospel of John. They're interrelated, as we'll see. The most common one is the invitation to believe in Jesus himself. That seems to be a kind of personal allegiance to Jesus. An example of that is 4:39. And actually, the Greek construction there, if we were to translate it quite literally, goes something like, believe into Jesus. So it means a belief, personal trust in Jesus. But related to that is the second object of faith, belief in the Gospel of John, believing the words that Jesus speaks. And of course, that's related to the first, isn't it? If you have a personal allegiance to Jesus, then you believe that which he teaches, that which he says. So that's not surprising. 2:22 is an example of that. But it's the third one that is interesting to me, and I should think would be of interest to you. There are a few occasions in which that John suggests believing in a proposition or a creed or a statement, most often that Jesus is the Son of the Father, that is believing a statement about Jesus. 11:27 is an example. Now that last one is important, and we can see the logic of it. If you have this kind of personal trust in Jesus, then believing statements or creeds about Jesus is a kind of a natural result, isn't it? But what happens there, a subtle shift takes place about which we ought to be concerned, and that is that faith as trust, personal trust, allegiance, to some degree is changed, is transformed into faith as dogma. Now, actually, in the New Testament itself, to back up for a moment, the primary understanding of faith is this kind of personal trust. That's Paul's concept of faith, too, I think. Toward the end of the New Testament period, in some of the late writings of the first century, you begin to see the concept that faith is an acceptance of a creed or a dogma. And what I want to suggest, and I shan't beat on this matter, but that this concept of faith is a rather distorted one if it is not rooted in this concept of faith. And I say that to Lutherans because we Lutherans are a creedal church. You know, we believe in the creeds, and that's important to us. But we've got to be careful, I think, that our Christian faith isn't just a matter of what you have in your head, what you give intellectual credit to, acceptance, intellectual acceptance. But faith is, first of all, trust. Well, that's a little sermon this morning. I won't charge you for that, and we'll just stick that in incidentally. The next thing we want to say about faith in the Gospel of John is that the noun faith is never used in the Gospel. It's always the verb. It's always pistuo or pistuein and never just pistis, which suggests perhaps that John understands faith to be a matter of action, dynamic, you see, and not static. For instance, sometimes we use the expression, we have faith. We have faith. Or the newer expression, keep the faith, as if you've got it. Well, I don't think John would be comfortable with that, because for John, faithing is always something you do over and over and over again. It isn't something that you've got and that you hang on to. It's a renewal, a continuous renewal of one's trust and one's acceptance. So that it isn't something you get in a box and tie up and you got it in your possession. Now, we'll have to look at that question a little more carefully later on when we come to the matter of, is faith just a free decision on my part, or is faith something that God does in my life? But either way, it is for John a dynamic kind of thing, you see, not a static state or condition or something of that sort. This leads me to another point in the Gospel of John, which I think is worth mentioning, and that is the relationship between believing and knowing. Because in the Gospel of John, these two words occur oftentimes in relationship to one another. And I think it's a question that many of us think about. Perhaps we don't lie awake at night worrying about the relationship between faith and knowledge, but that it is an issue that we ask about from time to time. There are passages in John where to believe and to know are used synonymously. In 669, for instance, it sounds as if to believe means to know something, to know Jesus, to know Jesus' relationship with God or something of that sort. But then there are passages in which believing leads to knowing. The disciples say something like, we believed and now we know that. So the suggestion is that out of belief there comes something that one knows. Knowledge of some sort. But look out, because in 1630, knowing leads to belief. And so in John, it seems like these two words form a kind of cycle, you see, all of one process. And you ask, how can that be? How is knowing synonymous with believing? I mean, I guess I know this chair to be real. I don't have to believe that the chair is real, do I? I know it to be real, and it's something quite different to say, I believe this chair can fly, or that this chair is really filled with spirits of some sort. There's quite a difference between that. That's a caricature, isn't it, of knowing. So, but we think of knowing as a matter of intellectual knowledge, and that stands apart from that kind of trust we've been talking about. And it's a different thing. Unless John is using the word to know, kinoskein, in the old sense of the Hebrew yada. And I've a hunch he is, otherwise I wouldn't bring this up here naturally. But in the Hebrew, yada is a different kind of knowing. Well, you've encountered this. Many of those present, let me put it that way, have used and known the old King James translation, right? That means that we're getting older, those of us who knew that. But remember, when you read the King James Bible, in the Old Testament sometimes, there was that strange kind of the passage where so-and-so went in and knew his wife, and she bore a son. Well, surely something more than an intellectual knowledge is going on there, right? He doesn't just know his wife intellectually. Something else has happened. That word is yada in the Hebrew. And it means an intimate exchange, an intimate relationship. So that to know something is not just to be able to stand back and comprehend it in your mind, but it is to come into relationship with that thing or that person. Hence, the word can be used for sexual intercourse and the kind of communication and interrelationship that occurs in the sexual act. Now, I suggest to you that when John uses this word know in relationship to believe, he may have that in mind. That the kind of knowing he's speaking about is not just the intellectual comprehension, but it is that personal interchange with another that is characteristic of the Hebrew concept of knowing or knowledge. Huh. Time for a sip of coffee. Questions or observations or uncertainties? Wake up time. Come on. Okay, the next question you're asking then, and I can see it on your lips, is the question of well, Bob, what's the relationship in the fourth gospel between faith and signs? Aren't you asking that question? No? Okay. Well, one of the interesting things, I mentioned this, is that John uses this word, ignore this for now, would you? Uses this word sign for the wondrous acts of Jesus. The wedding, the changing of the water into wine at Canaan is the first sign Jesus did, the evangelist tells us in 2:12. So somehow the sign, you see, that wondrous act is a pointer of some sort. And what is going on in the Gospel of John very often is the relationship between those signs and faith. Again, in 2:11 or 2:12 it is, those who witnessed the sign beheld the glory of Jesus and believed in him. So there seems to be the suggestion that to see the wondrous act of Jesus evokes faith on your part, right? And I think that we could say, yeah, okay, we understand that, and we see it in a number of places. The sign that Jesus does indicates who he is and hence gives persons an opportunity to believe in him. But then there are other passages in which John has Jesus be very critical of the signs and believing on him because of signs. The royal official comes to him in chapter 4 and asks that Jesus heal his son who is near death. And Jesus rebukes him, says, "Will you not believe unless you see signs?" Then Jesus goes on and performs the sign and heals the son, incidentally. But at times, Jesus is critical of believing in him only because of the works, the signs that he does. To see signs sometimes seems to be an insufficient ground for belief. And finally, finally, there is that interesting expression on the part of Jesus. It's a blessing, it's a beatitude. In chapter 20, we talked yesterday about Thomas's confession. Thomas sees the resurrected Christ and believes in chapter 20. And then, do you remember what Jesus says to him after he confesses, after he says, "My Lord and my God"? Does anyone know that passage? Aha! Pardon?
Because you have seen, you believe. Blessed are those who believe without seeing or something.
Exactly, yes. Now, in other words, what we see some places is that seeing signs evokes faith. Sometimes Jesus is critical of a faith that is based only on miracles and wonders, etc. And finally, the last words of Jesus in the gospel, if the gospel really ends at chapter 20, is this beatitude: blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. Blessed are those who have not had the experience that Thomas has had, you see. So that in John you see a kind of concept of faith, which we might put like this. I have a very simple mind, and I like to see things in little pictures. And so here's a little picture. First of all, signs do not always evoke faith. And that for one to see a sign, and on the basis of that, believe that Jesus is the Father's Son, already presupposes a kind of openness to faith, or if you will, an embryonic faith, the barest beginning of faith. So that John is telling us that faith, signs are ambiguous. God can do all the wonders he wants, and we do not necessarily have to believe, though, in God because those signs are always ambiguous. And the best example of this is in the Synoptic Gospels, when Jesus has done his wonders, and the question is, some believe in him, and some say he does these wonders because he is a servant of Satan. And you see, one who is from God or one who is a servant of Satan, they can both do signs, so we don't know if these signs indicate that Jesus is from God or that he's from Satan. The signs are ambiguous, in other words. So John would propose that, how shall we say it, miracles, wonders in our experience are helpful only if there is a kind of openness to see God's action in them in the first place. Sometimes we're tempted to say that if only unbelievers could see a sign, a wondrous experience, perhaps like the one we had, an answered prayer or something like that, they'd believe. Not necessarily. They're ambiguous. And there is no certainty about signs. I want to stress that in a moment. There's no certainty in signs. But so to believe on the basis of a sign already implies a certain openness to faith. But then if we believe in Jesus because of signs, then there is a kind of level of faith which we might call signs faith. And this is a faith, ladies and gentlemen, that is built on our perception of God's wondrous works, and we believe because of those, you see. I must tell you a story that is a kind of a confession, and I don't think Myrna's ever even heard this one. When I was a little boy, my first experience of answered prayer, this is really dumb, my first experience of answered prayer was that I wanted a certain toy gun for my birthday, and I remember praying for it, and by golly, I got that toy gun. You know, and I thought, ooh, man, God does answer prayer, you see. And I believed because of that, and only because of that. The next time I tried it and it didn't work, I was not so sure that God cared a hoot about me after all, you see. Well, that is a kind of signs faith. It's a kind of faith that is based upon the experience of wonders and that sort of thing. And it seems to me that John says, oh, that's all right, as one level of faith. But then there is another level of faith, which we might call mature faith, which is at the level of that beatitude. Blessed are those who see these signs and believe, but more blessed are those who do not see and yet believe. I want you to think about that for a moment. John, writing to second and third generation Christians who say, gee, if we had just lived in Jesus' time and if we'd seen what he'd done, gee, that would be great. We'd be much more faithful Christians then. And John has Jesus saying, no, not necessarily. If you believe without having never seen, you're more blessed than those who have seen. That beatitude really tosses me, you know, and really helps me. Because, quite frankly, I am not one who very often experiences, in recent years at least, experiences what we might call the work of God, the wonder of God, in somehow in my life. And yet I go on prodding along, believing nonetheless, even though those signs aren't necessarily around me. And what the word of Jesus tells me is, that's fine. Blessed are those who can believe without having seen. And if you are sometimes tempted to think of yourself, this is another little sermon, I'm sorry. If you're sometimes tempted to think of yourself as less of a believer because you don't have some of these marvelous experiences that other Christians talk about, of answered prayer and all this kind of thing, don't. Listen to that beatitude. Blessed are you if you believe without having seen. Okay, end of sermon. All right, those things that we've talked kind of help us understand the concept of faith in the Gospel of John. Do you have any questions or observations about them or anything? I kind of muddled my way through this last point, so I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't so clear. Yes?
Actually, I'm stuck on the thing before about the two ways of understanding the word to know.
Yes.
The verb to know.
Yeah.
And in chapter 8, St. Mary talks about we will know the truth and the truth will
set
you free.
Mm-hmm.
Can you interpret that within that Hebrew sort of concept of to know as coming into intimate relationship? Or there does it mean more intellectual knowledge?
No, I think that's a good example of where it means more than intellectual knowledge. It all kind of hinges on what you think John means by truth, there with the capital T. And I think John means the revelation of God in Christ, which is personal, which is the revelation in a person. Hence, to know the truth is to be in relationship with that person who is the truth, namely Christ, so that there, I think, is a good example of it of its meaning in the Hebrew sense. And therefore, it's not the idea that if you know the Nicene Creed or the Apostles' Creed, you will thereby be freed. It's not so much that as if you are in relationship, know this person, Jesus, and trust him and what he says and does, that is the liberation. At least that would be my reaction to. Does that help or make sense? What does your T-shirt say? Or maybe you'd rather not say in public.
Well, this was given to me as a gift, and the first thing I did when I got up here was to be sure that it was something presentable. I think at first it was some sort of a dismissive expletive.
Oh?
It isn't.
Oh.
It's simply dismissive. It means bug off.
Oh, really? Oh. Very appropriate.
In Swedish,
is it? That's neat. Yes, sir.
John, in 2031, what kind of faith do we have there? In the sign that you might believe Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that there we have a hint of that earlier kind of faith that is built upon signs. Let's see. These are written, and the these refers to the signs, don't they? Doesn't it? So, in effect, what we've got, I would have to say that is a reference to a faith that is born from this rehearsal of the signs. Unless one wants to say that here at the end of the book now, John is using that word sign in a different way, where he's used it for the marvelous acts of God before. Now, after the passion story, the death and resurrection, now he's using that word in a much broader sense, not just a wondrous act, but Jesus' whole life and death. But if that's not the case, then you see that verse 31 and 30 stand kind of in relationship with this other kind of faith that was just mentioned before, faith without seed. So I'm not sure which way one should take it, but is that what you were getting at?
I'm just wondering how you're going to relate it.
Yeah.
Sacrificing his own
God. Yeah, yeah. Okay, that's a good point. Yes, that's an important, as you say, prototype of faith in the Old Testament.
Are we living in a time where people like signs for faith, too, do you think? More so than, I mean, it seems to me right now that some of the churches that are gaining members mm-hmm. and everything are the churches where that type of preaching is taking place, where mm-hmm. they are told how to live and what to live in, and prayer can answer these. Mm-hmm. So we have people who say that Jesus wakes them every morning at 7 mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, prayer is such an inward. We have all these experiences, and mm-hmm. and I didn't know if you were alluding to that when you said, well, maybe, you know, there are those of us who have not, who've been Christian mm-hmm. many, many years and had a relationship and maybe don't have.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Do you think it's more now than it ever was, or is that just...
Well, I don't know about that, but I know that there are a good many Christians, you know, who
like that.
Speak of, you know, those wonders. And... Yeah, sometimes those of us who are, what shall I say, more traditional Lutherans Saji. At least, yeah, Saji, we don't have that experience, and we're likely to feel, you know, inferior to them, and I don't think that's necessary. And that is not to put that kind of Christianity down at all. It's just to say that it's there's another kind that is as legitimate. Yes, sir?
Oh. That's one step further. I had my... One church that I'm very familiar with, to say, my parents go there, were saying that if you really had faith, you could speak in tongues.
Oh.
And for some reason, that really kind of hit me kind of strange, because the speaking in tongues is a sign. I think there was something that was a little bit confusing in that line.
But yeah, that's a good example of what I think you were, the revival of the speaking in tongues, what we call the charismatic movement, but I don't like that expression because that means gifted by grace, and we are all gifted by grace, whether we speak in tongues or not. So, but we call it the charismatic movement. But yes, that's sometimes a sign to others that the God is present, you know, in this community, and therefore that helps you believe. So it functions sometimes as a sign. Wonder in this same way. What were you going to say? Did you want to add?
Well, I just thought that it seems to me that sometimes it's more appealing mm-hmm. to certain types of people. I mean, I think that they really, that they find the Lord in this way.
Sure.
They seem to need this.
Yes, yeah.
I'm not putting it down, but I just say it seems like it's a kind of a popular theology to me.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. And, The business about the miracles in the Roman Catholic tradition are the same kind of thing, and the shroud to some degree, and that whole debate, you know, regardless of how you come out on that debate, you know, if that is the image of Christ there, that's a marvel that will evoke our faith, will help our faith. And I'm just saying that there's a legitimate way of believing without embracing and having those kinds of experiences. That's all. Well, I want to move on to our second question since it's 9:30, and I think I can do this one relatively shortly, and we can then get to the question of predestination and what that may mean. In the Gospel of John, there is mentioned over and over again a kind of dualism, and that is two opposite poles, one of which represents truth and faith and revelation, and the other one which represents falsehood and absence of faith, the absence of revelation. The two most easiest of these to grasp, I think, is, let me get this off the board, is the light and darkness motif, which I've already mentioned once before. I want to move on to our second question, since it's 9:30, And I think I can do this one relatively shortly, and we can then get to the question of predestination and what that may mean. In the Gospel of John, there is mentioned over and over again a kind of dualism, and that is two opposite poles, one of which represents truth and faith and revelation, and the other one which represents falsehood and absence of faith, the absence of revelation. The two most easiest of these to grasp, I think, is, let me get this off the board, is the light and darkness motif, which I've already mentioned once before. That there is a realm of light over against the realm of darkness. And the realm of light is the realm of belief and revelation. It's also the world above as opposed to the world below, which is false. And this realm is the realm of truth. And there are others, you know, that we could go on. For instance, oftentimes the word world is used in that sense of the negative pole. Now, the thing that I want to impress on you for the moment is that John sort of sees this polarity everywhere in human existence. And he mentions it again and again and again in different ways, in subtle ways, those who belong to the world versus those who do not. And the thrust of it is sort of, you know, there are two ways of life. And which way of life will you choose? Or where are you in which way of life? And in a sense, the reason it fits into our discussion this morning is that faith seems to be the means by which one can make a transition from the world of darkness to the world of light. Of course, this whole realm is made possible because of God's revelation. Let's not doubt that. Because God has revealed himself in the Logos, there is for us the option of believing and making the transition from one realm to the other. But John sees the world in kind of two opposites. And the impact of this in the Gospel of John is that you choose and you're on one side or the other and there is no in-between. There's no in-between. And so John is a gospel that is most radical in that way. It is John which is sometimes the most exclusivistic. No one comes to the Father except by me, Jesus is made to say. And so there's no in between. There's no, well, I'm on my way to believing, but I'm not there yet, you know. And when I try hard every day, John would say, no, that's not it. You're either here or you're there. And so in a sense, bless him, John is kind of simplistic in this way. Kind of simplistic. Because you and I know that there is indeed a lot of points in between. And most of us lie somewhere in between the light and the darkness. One moment we're in the darkness, and then maybe the next moment we see a glimpse of light. Whoops, there we are back again in the darkness of unbelief and our own stupidity and stumbling, ignorance and all the rest. But John sees things in that two-pole way. And as I say, I think the thrust of it is in order that, one, get this picture of you either believe or you don't believe. And it's a call to decision, if you will. It's a call to decision. Now, I want to take this point to say a couple of words about two terms in John. The first one is world. And to say that sometimes that word world is used as a symbol for the realm of darkness. And you want to be careful, because he is not speaking of world in terms of, you know, the physical around us. He's not saying that what we eat or what we drink is evil, but he's talking about world as the realm of unbelief in opposition to God's revelation and God's creation. And the main point I want to make is don't take this word to degrade the material, the physical. That's not what John means by it. John is very Hebraic in the sense that the physical, the material world is created by God and hence is good. So he doesn't mean it that way. It is rather the world of unbelief. More seriously, I suppose, I want to take a moment to clear my conscience about this, because I have a commitment that every time I teach John, I say something about this because I think it's so important, even though it doesn't always fit what we're doing. I want to warn you about the way the expression "the Jews" is used in the Gospel of John. Most often, that word is used in a pejorative way, a negative way. The Jews are the unbelievers. The Jews are the opponents to Jesus. The Jews are the ones who put Jesus to death. There is no book in the New Testament which has the greater power to support anti-Semitism than the Gospel of John. And you think about it as sometime as you read it. And if you've got a streak of anti-Semitism in you yourself, you might recognize how those references to the Jews, you kind of like that. Or those of you, well, I don't want to go on and on. But what I want to say is that we think John was written in the midst of a controversy between the Christian church and the synagogue of John's city. That the questions facing the church for which John was writing at the moment he was writing was this relationship, this dialogue between the Jews and the Christians. And the Jews were accusing the Christians of worshiping two gods, of violating the Torah and all the rest. And hence, because of that setting, John uses the word "the Jews" in a pejorative sense. And he means it in that situation, in that community, the Jews of that synagogue. And he does not mean thereby to condemn a whole race or nationality of people. And we need to be careful not to take his words to mean to do that. Is that point clear? No? Pardon? No? No? Okay. That the fact that, I'll try it again, back up and try it again. The fact that John uses that word in a pejorative way so often and makes the Jews the opponents does not suggest, I think, that John is condemning a whole race of people, a whole nationality. As a matter of fact, I believe that John himself was a Jewish Christian, one who had been a Jew and was now converted to Christianity, and that many of the Christians to whom he writes are Jewish Christians. And part of the purpose of the Gospel of John is to show that Jesus' teaching is not contradictory to the Torah. He uses the term in a negative sense because he is at that moment in dialogue with the Jews. That's the sort of immediate setting for his book. It would be sort of like in a movement to get something done in a city, you speak of the local government in a negative way all the time. You don't mean by that to condemn the whole idea of city government. You mean that this particular city government is not responding the way they should to this situation. And you don't thereby, you wouldn't want your words taken to mean that we should dissolve city governments everywhere in favor of some other system. And so I don't think John is saying that Jews are in every situation the opponents of Jesus, the ones who put Jesus to death, the ones who must be overcome. He means rather that this local situation is that way, and really has an openness to Judaism in general. I hope that that makes my point, but we must go on. And that is really a little editorial comment to this whole thing to help soothe my conscience.
You want to leave that there?
Okay, I will, but I won't necessarily.
What I'm thinking is somebody else coming in and looking at this without your explanation.
I see. Okay. Right, yes, no. I always... Erase the evidence.
I
thought you said, do I want to leave the topic there?
But
no. Okay. No, I don't want to leave it there. I don't want that association made. Let us then turn to our last question for today, and that is the question of, are we free to believe or not to believe? Or is faith, in some sense, an act of God within our lives? And the reason I bring this question up is that I haven't any axe to grind or anything, but it's because in the Gospel of John there is an ambiguity at that point. That is, if you read John carefully, sometimes you feel, yeah, John says, faith is a free choice, it's a decision I make. And other times you think, hey, wait a minute, now John is saying that it is God who makes faith possible in my life, and my faith decision, my decision isn't really what constitutes faith at all, but rather what God does in my life. And I want to quickly give you the evidence for the two sides of this. And I must tell you that every time I do this, I try to figure out where the passages which seem to suggest that faith is a free choice. Some of the comments of the evangelists, like 1935 and that chapter 20, verse 31, these things are written that you may believe, sounds like it's a possibility. Then there are passages where all or everyone, in the Greek is pas pantas, all or everyone is invited to believe. And there are a whole slew of those. One immediate example is that beloved verse of 3:16. God so loved the world that he gave his son that we might believe, therefore, and have eternal life. So there's that kind of all-encompassing. Then there are a couple of times in which the imperative form of the word believe is used. For instance, Jesus says in one of the farewell discourses, you believe in God, believe also in me. And it's a demand, it's an imperative. Well, now it doesn't make any sense to demand love, belief if belief is not a possibility, a free act on our part. And then there are some other passages in which there is a kind of a general invitation to believe, a general inviting of people to believe. And then there are some other passages, and I want to... which, you know, there's always a miscellany category, isn't it? There's always some that do not fit the categories you've created, so you have to have a miscellaneous box. But I want to use this one, 667 and following. It comes at the end of chapter 6, where Jesus has made that startling bread of life speech. Remember, I am the bread of the bread from heaven, the bread of life. And remember, in the course of that, he says, unless you eat my flesh, and the Greek verb there might better be translated gnaw, or crunch on my flesh, and drink my blood, you do not have any part of me. After hearing that, understandably, some of those who followed him said, no more. This guy's gone over the far end, you know, and they will no longer believe in him. And so John tells us, the narrator tells us, many turned away and would no longer follow Jesus, follow in the sense of discipleship there. And so then Jesus turns to the intimate disciples, the 12, and he says, will you too leave me? Now, my point is that they seem to be free at that point to leave as the others have been free. And it's at this point that Peter makes that response, which allows us, gives us a reason, we Lutherans, to sing the hallelujah between the second and gospel lesson. You know, to whom shall we go? You have the words of reply. If Peter hadn't said that, I don't know what we would do between the second and third lesson. We'd be at a loss. But, in other words, Peter says, no, we'll follow you. But they're free at that point, apparently, to leave Jesus, as do the others. Now, quickly, the other side of the issue are some passages in which Jesus, or the gospel in general, seems to suggest that faith is God's act in our lives. I usually have to emphasize this because most people say, yeah, amen to this side, but oops to this side, you know, not so sure about this side. There are a whole series of passages in which it's said that the Father gives the believers to Jesus. No one comes to Jesus except those who are given to him by God. It's as if God picks these people up and puts them over into the hands of Jesus. And the implication of that is that it's not my act which creates faith, but it is God's taking me and giving me to Jesus. And that is made even clearer in a more drastic way in 644. There's only one occurrence of this, and it is only those who come, those who come to Christ are only those whom the Father has drawn. As if to tug, to pull, to lead, a magnetic power of some kind that pulls you out and pulls you to Christ. So it sounds like there, my decision to believe or not to believe is not nearly as important as whether God's power is pulling me toward belief. And if not, then I can't believe. If it is, then I do believe. The third category here are what we might call the affiliation passages. This is a simple idea that one is either affiliated with one realm or with the other realm. One is either one of the sheep of Jesus' pastor, or later on in that chapter, one is not a member of that flock. And whether or not you believe depends on to which group you are affiliated. Those who belong to the world cannot hear the truth. Those who do not belong to the world are those who hear the truth. In other words, it kind of seems like we're divided right down the middle here. Quick, I'm going to get on the believing side. And this side, you see, is affiliated with darkness and sin. Look at them. Aren't they sinners over there? And they have no chance of believing. While we on this side, we're affiliated with light and truth and Christ also. We believe. It sounds as if God has drawn this distinction. We're either children, there's the sheep business, we're either children of God or children of the devil. We either belong to Christ and the truth or we do not. Then there are some other passages down here which seem to make this point. If I've convinced you, then what we have is evidence for both sides. Evidence that faith is a free act, and evidence that faith is God's act within our lives. Now, what do we do with this? Well, there are a number of options. Unless, of course, we want to say, excuse me, where is that other picture I want to give you? There it is. Assuming now that we do not want to say that John was so muddle-headed that he didn't know what he was writing, that he was not conscious of this contradiction, he was dummy enough not to see it for himself. Unless you want to say that, it seems to me that we have two choices. One is what we usually do, what people usually do. It takes one set of passages, either those for freedom or those for God's act, and reads the other set of passages in the light of the first. In other words, You take the freedom passages and they are the truth, and then everything that is said under what might seem determinism is read in the light of this truth. In other words, those who are drawn by the Father, of course, are those who have made the decision to believe. And until you make the decision to believe, God cannot call it, draw you. You see, that would be one way of reading it. Or you reverse it, as the old predestinarian Presbyterians used to love to do, and read the freedom passages in the light of the determinism. I am free to choose only if God draws me to Jesus. And if he doesn't, then I have no power, no freedom at all. In each case, you take one set of passages as more important, and you read the other set in the light of that first set. The other option is to say that John really knew what he was doing, and he meant both sets of passages. And he's proposing, therefore, that truth is found in the tension between those two points, those two poles of truth. In other words, when you ask the question of where does my faith come from, you are not saying the whole truth unless to some degree you affirm both of these. Now, what would that mean? What would that mean to affirm both of them? It would mean that, yes, there's a sense in which faith is my decision. There's a sense in which unless I make that decision, you know, I cannot believe. But there's another sense in which faith in my life is always mysterious. And it's the sense that the mystery of it is that I am able to believe. My gosh, you know, I'm able to believe. And that is the gift of God. So that you have to say that there is this action of God in your life which makes it possible for you to believe before your free will makes any choice, it makes any difference at all. So I'm suggesting to you that there is a truth in each of these, and that what John was suggesting to us was a tension between those two truths. And anytime we lower the tension, anytime we begin to say that one side is more important than the other, we begin to lose the truth as John understood it. Now, I'm not saying this is the true view. I'm saying this is what I think John is saying. And so the results of it are, let me see how I set it here, would you? Because I can, if I get it off the paper, it's a little more accurate than if I ad lib it. Faith, then, is a divine gift. And faith is an act of will. In the first case, faith is a divine gift, means that we can never take credit for our faith. We can never say, oh, look at me, I believe. Boy, aren't I great, huh? Boy, God must really like me because I believe. In other words, faith cannot be reduced to a work, to use language that Lutherans ought to understand. But the other side of the issue is that we are still ultimately responsible for whether or not we believe. We're ultimately responsible. So we can't say, you know, it's all that God has done and I'm not responsible. Okay, you know, the devil made me do it and that kind of jazz. No. The tension between these two, the aspect of freedom, means that we are always to some degree responsible for our faith. If you feel as if you're straddling a fence right now, that's precisely where I feel I am, and that's where I want you to feel you are, caught between two and not able to let go of either one. We have 4 minutes. Vast discussion now in 4 minutes. Yes.
Back to this dualism question.
Mm-hmm.
John was certainly right. His enemies were not only the Jews, they were also other Christian communities who didn't believe some of the same things, like pre-existence or whatever. Right?
could be. We're not sure about that part of it, but go ahead.
If that's true, then where would he put them in this light darkness thing?
Oh.
I wondered if there was a space, someplace in between for other Christian communities that didn't believe correctly.
Yeah, I think that John in the Gospel was not so aware are not really dealing with the question of other Christian communities. He recognizes their existence when he says, you know, has Jesus say, other sheep I have that are not of this fold, but he doesn't really condemn or... Now, when you look at the epistles of John, the letters of John, which follow the Gospel of John chronologically, we think, there the question is the relationship of one group of Christians who feel that they have the truth, as opposed to another group that at least the first group understands to be heretical. So what happens in the epistles, insofar as this dualism is continued, it's a Christian group that's put over here on the darkness side. But I'm not so sure that that's evident in the gospel itself. Yes?
There's a passage in chapter 8 where it talks about the children of the devil.
Yes.
I guess we've been into that polarity a little more clearly.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a little trouble with that if you have a minute to spend on kind of my perception of all of us being children of God and kind of trying to interpret this in light of that, what he's saying that.
Mm-hmm.
Some people really can't hear God's word, they're children of the devil. So there are really two worlds mingled here.
Well, I guess we begin with the idea that there is little recognition that we are by nature children of God. There's little recognition of that. The children of God are those who have been made children of God and are not by nature children of God. Is that clear? I mean, sometimes we say, you know, all people are children of God, and we mean all people regardless of just the fact that they exist. They've been created by God, they're children of God. I don't think that's the way John means it here. He means children of God, those who have become part of the believing community. Of course, this business about... you see, here the question is, he's arguing with the Jews. And they claim to be children of Abraham. And he's saying that you're not children of Abraham, and that's true, that's evident by the fact that you do not accept Christ. If you were a child of Abraham, you would accept Christ. And so then he has Jesus call them children of the devil, not of Abraham. It would be like saying, you're not a true Lutheran. You're really a Calvinist, not a Lutheran. It would be that kind of. You see, that was a, what shall I want? How do I want to say it? That was a terrible thing to say to a group of Jews, you know, who felt that more deeply than anything else, that they were children of Abraham. Now, I don't know if that helps.
I guess it's a limited. You're saying it's a limited context here that I need to interpret this in, and not extract from that sort of a world view of this.
Aren't you back to John's acts again that he's grinding with a particular Jewish community?
Yeah, right. Though I think John would accept in his polarity, he would accept children of God on the left-hand column and children of the devil who belong to the world, etc., in the right-hand column. Well, we are 1 minute overdue, and so we must adjourn. Tomorrow, we want to address the concept of the Spirit in the Gospel of John, and we want to talk about this whole concept of being born again, because that's in the Gospel of John in chapter 3. So we'll have a go at that tomorrow.